listen to this sad, sad story of the Akron Queen of the Air. Once the triumph of the Navy, now but a memory there. We can always replace an aircraft in beauty every way, but we can't replace those brave souls who lost their lives that day.
For some reason, in the early 20th century, audiences were eager for songs about natural and man-made disasters, floods, train wrecks, fires, suicides, sensational murders, in this case, the crash of a Navy Zeppelin. Hank Sapusnik has compiled disaster songs from the era of American roots music in a new 3-CD anthology called People Take Warning, Murder Ballads and Disaster Songs, 1913 to 1938. And I'm pleased it has brought him back to the show today. Hello.
Hi, Len.
During your previous visits, we've talked about Yiddish music and about your career as a banjo player. How did you wind up putting together an anthology of disaster songs?
Well, my other hat, other than the yarmulke, is old-time country music. I've been a big fan of American roots music for many years. I did an anthology a few years ago on Charlie Poole, who was one of the pioneers of country music, and that sort of put me back into looking at early roots recordings in a sort of a different way.
And then as you were looking through them, you noticed that there were an awful lot of songs about murders and natural disasters, floods and everything you can imagine.
Well, when you think about American country music, a lot of times the real bedrock of American country music are old ballads, murder ballads that were imported when emigres came from England. And the idea that recordings actually came to the South very late, actually in some ways later than radio. And this was how a lot of people actually got their news, from street corner singers and from people who were outside of courthouses. So it really was emblematic of how people learned what was going on.
So they heard them first in live performances on from people who were trying to get money by doing performances out in the street, and then eventually bought the records if they had enough to pay for them?
Yeah, that was, for example, there were a whole series of recordings done about the trial of Leo Frank, who was accused of murdering a young girl who worked for him in a pencil factory in Atlanta. And there was a singer named Fiddlin' John Carson who was situated outside of the courthouse in Atlanta, basically doing, you know, kind of like a law and order kind of every day an update on the goings-on in the trial.
Well, that was a case of Southern anti-Semitism. So were the songs pro-Leo Frank or anti-Leo Frank?
Decidedly anti.
Where does the title of this anthology, People Take Warning, come from?
It's a biblical. It turns up quite a number of times in the Old Testament. And part of it, because of the structure of the songs, they have a kind of an almost a biblical trajectory. It's because it's about you can't fool God, and you can't, you know, it's about hubris a lot of times.
So God's will plays a part in many of these songs. How would you define American roots music? Because it cuts across racial lines. Are there things that would tie the white and black traditions together?
Well, a lot of them, especially songs of natural disasters. The flood, the 1927 Mississippi flood, affected whites and blacks equitably.
Well, we actually have one of the tracks that you have done for that, the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927, by Robert Hicks, but there was also a white version. Maybe we can listen to a little bit of Robert Hicks, and then you can talk about how the two compare.
I was walking down the levee with my head hanging low, looking for my sweet mama, but she ain't here no more. That's why I'm crying, Mississippi heavy water blue. Lord, 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 I'm so blue. My house got washed away, and I'm crying how long for another payday. That's why I'm crying, Mississippi heavy water blues.
That's Mississippi Heavy Water Blues by Robert Hicks, but also on the anthology is The Story of the Mighty Mississippi by Ernest Stoneman. Did they have anything in common other than they both use the flood as a reference point?
Well, what happened with early record labels is that the A&R men, the guys who were responsible for choosing the material or telling the artist what to do, kept blacks from becoming... black performers were a lot broader than just playing blues. And so what happened is that they kind of forced them to playing stuff that they thought would sell rather than what accurately reflected what the artist performed. Ernest Stoneman, who was an incredibly important early figure in country music, he was one of the people who helped find the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers. He actually learned A Story of the Mighty Mississippi from a black performer.
Well, there was a lot of cross-referencing. Jimmy Rogers, the original Jimmy Rogers, he sang a lot of blues, didn't he?
Yeah, very influenced by black music. And this was the whole thing, that there was a really strong back and forth between white and black performers. The record labels, however, were very, very clear about a certain kind of demarcation between what was considered white music and what was black.
Well, we know that in gospel music, people like Elvis and Johnny Cash listened to black performers, Sister Rosetta Tharpe. And I've been told by a number of black gospel singers that when they were traveling from town to town in the South, they turned on the radio and they listened to Will the Circle Be Unbroken or Great Speckled Bird, white gospel songs, and then they would do their versions of them.
Yeah, there were, in fact, a lot of people talk about the Benny Goodman sessions in the 30s as being the first mixed-race recording sessions, but they actually go back to the turn of the 20th century where white and black performers first recorded together. It's a real tradition.
Did the soundtrack for the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou create a renewed interest in this part of the American musical tradition?
Very much so. T-Bone Burnett very, very wisely really took from the traditional recorded repertoire and made that part of really brought it back to a general cultural literacy.
And then I'm sure a lot of contemporary performers started thinking about it. Tom Waits wrote the introductory essay for this very handsomely put-together set of recordings. I mean, nowadays, you can do a teeny little thing and have three or four CDs in it, but this is almost like a little book.
It's actually meant to replicate a hymnal, 19th century shape note hymnal with the layout. These days, reissues are more about the package in a lot of ways. This is really a big change in how music is delivered to people.
We talked about disaster songs by blacks and whites marketed differently, but there was even a Yiddish disaster song that you've included in this collection.
Actually, what's really interesting when you look at the history of commercial recording is that the earliest strain of commercial recording actually has these kinds of broadside events. It was actually my co-producer, who was not Jewish, who recommended putting in the Yosela Rosenblatt Prayer for the Dead based on the sinking of the Titanic. And really is to show that these are events that touched everyone's lives equally.
Now, Yosela Rosenblatt was one of the greatest stars of Jewish music during the time, a cantor who famously turned down an opportunity to sing at the Metropolitan Opera because he'd have to sing on Saturday. Mm-hmm.
But he didn't turn down a chance to be in the Jazz Singer.
Now, the Titanic seems to have inspired an incredible number of songs. We were talking earlier about Ernest Stoneman. Maybe we can listen to a little bit of his song from 1924 called The Titanic.
It was on Monday morning, just about 1 o'clock, that the great Titanic began reeling rock. Then the people began to cry, saying, Lord, I'm going to die. It was sad when that great ship went down.
Have more songs been written about the sinking of the Titanic in 1912 than any other single disaster?
I can't really think of another disaster that was as long-lived in terms of the public consciousness. It really reigns as the king of hubris songs.
But that's the song. There are many variations of it, but
yeah.
When the Great Ship Went Down is the refrain that we hear in all the different versions?
No, that was only in a couple of versions. It was really something that was so emblematic to people. I mean, these are people who were landlocked. It's not that they were ever going to be on a luxury liner like the Titanic, but the idea of man's ability, it was the Tower of Babel on the ocean. It really allowed people a sense of using it as a way to talk about get right with God, don't be above your raising.
And then there are murder ballads. Did these emerge around the same? Well, you say that they came actually part of an English tradition. Is there a formula for this kind of song?
Well, murder ballads, I think, as I write in the notes, street singers found that natural disaster songs made them pretty good money. Train wrecks made better money, but murder ballads made the best money. And first-person murder ballads, that is, gallows confessionals, were incredibly popular.
Well, and they continued into the rock and roll era, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, anything, you know, tell Laura I love her.
Well, I'm in the jailhouse. And Johnny Cash seemed to make a specialty of murder ballads and jailhouse ballads.
He wasn't the man in black for nothing. but I think the whole thing with murder ballads, it really is, you know, people are watching cops on TV. You know, there's this kind of visceral kind of you are there aspect. Most of the murder ballads are about unfortunate lovers who had the bad luck to become pregnant. And this really goes back to some of the songs that were brought. Some of them, the songs were popular because they were performed at the site of the murder.
Mm. And or as you say, at the trial.
Yeah. It was very much for people a sense of a kind of a visceral connection to the event.
Now, why do you think the song involving Billy Lyons and Stacco Lee has been so enduring to the point where it was a rock and roll hit as Stagger Lee?
Yes, Stagger Lee, yeah. Again, I think it's you know, I use the Dick Clark. You know, the idea, it's got a good beat. It's a terrific song. And what's really great about this particular version is it's about the refrain is really not that you know, it's just when you lose, learn to lose. It's almost like a life lesson.
That's Ferry Lewis's version.
Yeah.
Well, then there are so many other ones. Mississippi John Hurt did one that many people will remember.
It came off the folk circuit. That was made popular at the Newport Festival.
Are we still getting disaster songs, for example? Were there any songs that followed 9/11 or Hurricane Katrina that you know of?
Certainly not in the quantity. I mean, when you see what had come out in the 20s and 30s, and mind you, when these recordings were made, people were, some of the singers, like Vernon Dalhart, would scour the daily paper to find an event. He did his big hit, which was song about a trapped miner, actually got made into a movie, Billy Wilder's Ace in the Hole. And the idea that...
With Kirk Douglas.
With Kirk, one of the great noir films. And because news traveled less quickly after World War II with television and now with the internet, there really isn't a need. By the time someone writes a song and gets it recorded, everyone knows about it already. It doesn't have that same you are there aspect to it.
So we make up different versions like Billy Joe... You know, jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. That was, but that's not based on a real story. So many of these are based on real events.
And because these things, especially train wrecks, this was the lifeline of early America, and it really meant a lot because people's lives literally depended on this kind of thing. So these kind of local events stood in for. Even if it happened locally, it had great resonance with people outside of the area.
Another disaster was the boll weevil, which destroyed the cotton crop, and we'll go out with W.A. Lindsay and Alvin Condor's version of the song Boll Weevil from 1928. My great thanks to Henry Sapoznik, or Hank Sapoznik, as his name appears on this record. People Take Warning, Murder Ballads and Disaster Songs, 1913 to 1938, released by Tompkins Square. I almost said records, but we don't say that anymore,
right,
do we?
We don't say, you say albums. No one knows why they still call it albums. It's, but yeah, it is Tompkins Square.
Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having
me. That booger, he's walking here and there. Well, I had a home. Well, I had a home.